On this episode of Skeptico.
You know, Houston would always point out that when he was teaching religion, he was teaching the ideals of the various religions and not necessarily the realities. And what he pointed out, and the reason that he felt comfortable just teaching ideals, is he said, well, you know, a music professor doesn't have to teach all the bad music, too. He just teaches the good music. And there's something to that. I mean, I think that's fair. You know, if you're doing a history of the world, then the mistakes that religions make do come up. You know, Houston used to quote Ramakrishna, who once said that religion is like a cow. It kicks, but it does give milk.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, I have an interview with Dr. Dana Sawyer, who's written a terrific biography on Houston Smith. Now, Dana is quite an interesting guy, a scholar, and in a lot of ways, once you know the two of them, has followed in the footsteps of Houston Smith in some pretty amazing ways. But we're really not going to talk too much about Dana's career, because we're going to talk instead about this amazing person, Houston Smith, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, but for those of you who haven't, is probably the greatest modern academic in religious studies and was really a pioneer in the whole field of religious studies. You know, before Houston Smith came around, religious studies meant the study of why these stupid people believe these stupid things, or why religion is okay, but why my religion is a little bit better than everyone else's. So Houston Smith came along and really changed all that in a way you'll hear about in this interview. And he also has lived through, he's in his 90s now, so he's still alive, but he won't be with us much longer. He's lived through some pretty amazing times that our guest, Dana Sawyer, talks about. So stick around for the interview. Before we get there, I just wanted to make a quick announcement by way of playing a voice message that I received from Laura and Kevin over at 11 Story about their documentary, The Deeper You Go. It's now available for free. You can watch it. We've talked about it before with them, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes. Here it goes.
Greetings, Alex and the Skeptico community. This is Kevin from 11 Story. Our brief documentary on the science of consciousness, The Deeper You Go, is now available to the public. You can access it at 11story.com. It's the number 11, thstory.com. Thanks again, Alex, for having us on the show earlier this year.
Okay, so that's that. Now let's get on to my interview with Dr. Dana Sawyer. Today we welcome Dr. Dana Sawyer to Skeptico. Dana is a professor of religion and philosophy at the Maine College of Art and the author of Houston Smith, Wisdom Keeper, Living the World's Religions, the authorized biography of a 21st century spiritual giant. Dana, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining me on Skeptico.
Thanks for inviting me. Great to be here.
So on the back of this book cover, people are going to find a blurb by the Dalai Lama. Now, first of all, I don't imagine that the Dalai Lama gives out a lot of book blurbs, but he did for this one. And what he wrote is really, I think, interesting. He said, Houston Smith is an outstanding authority on the world's religions because he has put so many of them into practice and discovered their real taste. Who is Houston Smith?
Well, you know, one time the Christian Science Monitor referred to him as religion's rock star, and he was certainly that. For more than 50 years, Houston Smith was the most renowned scholar of the world religions in the world. And so, you know, he had written a book in 1958 called The Religions of Man that's now called The World's Religions, to correct that mistake of non-inclusive language. But that book has never been out of print since 1958. And the vast majority of college students or people who went to college and have ever taken a course on world religions read that book. That was the textbook. And so that was a breakthrough kind of book for Houston, but it was also a breakthrough book in the academic study of religion, because prior to that book, most people felt like the job of an academic was to deconstruct religion, you know, explain to us in modernist terms why religion was over with and why we were better off without all that silly superstition. And Houston started in a very different place, which was, rather than judging the religions, he simply wanted to be a good academic and describe them. And that's what he did. And that book, each chapter is written in such a way that a believer of that particular tradition would be nodding their head yes, like, or yes, that is what Hinduism he is describing accurately. This right. is what I believe. And then in the next chapter, he does that for Buddhism, etc. So that's, you know, one of the answers you can give.
Before you give another one, because the whole book that you've done here is really a broader look at all the answers to that question, which I think is wonderful. Tell folks a little bit about how you came to write this biography.
Well, about 14 years ago, I wrote a biography of Aldous Huxley.
A very critically well-received biography of Aldous Huxley, we should say, but go ahead.
That's right. That's right. In fact, his wife, Laura Huxley, told me that of all the books that had been written on Aldous, and you can imagine there were a lot written about Huxley, that was the only book that he would have liked and agreed with. And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I mean, that was pretty amazing praise. But anyway, I wrote that book, and then I was in Berkeley on the book tour, and I asked Houston if I could come and visit him because he had endorsed that book. And when we met, he asked me what I was going to write next, and I said, how about your biography? He didn't realize he'd been a great hero of mine for a long time. And he was surprised, and he said, oh, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. And I talked him into it. It took a while, but I talked him into it.
You mentioned that he was somewhat of a hero of yours. Throughout this book, and knowing a little bit of your background, I do see that kindred spirit kind of thing going on. And even in, I think, some of the adventures and battles that you both have undergone in academia, there is that sense. Tell people a little bit more about that kindred spirit nature of it and your background.
Well, I felt like I had been studying at his feet invisibly for about 40 years, going all the way back to undergraduate school. But I did my first master's degree at the University of Hawaii, and Houston came out there to give a talk, and it must have been 76 or 77. And I went up to talk to him afterwards, and I was like, you know, a 14-year-old girl faced with Justin Bieber or something. I couldn't even talk. I don't even remember what I said to him. I was probably in a cold sweat. It was just, you know, when you meet your great heroes, it has a real effect on you. And part of the reason for that was not only that Houston had described the religions accurately, and I'm not particularly a religious person at all. I don't belong formally to a religion. But I really admired how Houston had gone toe-to-toe with secular materialists. And, you know, I'm sure you've talked about this before on your program, Alex. There's a word, scientism, which is when you're raising scientific knowledge to the status of the only truth. Then Houston, who did his PhD in philosophy at the University of Chicago, he could really fight our colleagues in academia to a standstill. He could get them to the place where they had to wonder again. You know, they had to see that they themselves were perhaps being too dogmatic in their own assumptions, you know, guilty of what they were accusing religionists of being. And I really admired that about Houston.
You say that Houston Smith reclaimed the significance of metaphysics in the study of philosophy. Yeah, please expound on that.
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, he made very strong arguments in books like Beyond the Postmodern Mind, Forgotten Truth, Why Religion Matters. for the limits of science, that science is a wonderful thing and it can answer many questions. But people who embrace it as the only truth are they're jumping to conclusions. For example, Bertrand Russell once said, what science can't prove, mankind can't know. That's a statement where you're saying whatever can't be quantified must be false, must be a sophistry of some kind that should be dismissed. But if we start at the place of saying, and I know this will come out awkwardly, I'll do my best. If we start at an axiomatic assumption that only those truths that can be scientifically proven to be true are true, good luck trying to scientifically prove that axiom.
Right. It's a premise, not a conclusion.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's a presumptuous presumption.
Yeah, right. Right. You know, you touched on this before and you just touched on it again, the postmodern nature of academia, particularly at the time that Houston Smith entered the academy. But I don't think, this is the great thing about history, and this book is a slice of history, I don't think people can have a real sense of what that was really about. I scribbled down a couple of notes, infantile projection and opiate of the masses. Can you maybe expound a little bit more on the climate that existed of all the really smart guys when Houston entered the field of religious studies?
Yeah, well, you know, when he was coming along in the 40s and 50s, began his teaching career in 1947, then modernism still had a very strong hold on the academy. I mean, I would argue today, and my colleague Jeff Kripal down at Rice University would also argue, it continues to have a hold on the academy. But the view was, Freud had it right, that we, as babies, realize there are limits to our own abilities, but there are these giants called mom and dad that come and take care of us, and they have much more unlimited abilities. And so Freud says, eventually we'll realize even our parents are limited beings. And so out of an infantile longing for safety, we'll project upon a benign universe a cosmic mom and dad to take care of us. So Freud is saying, basically, instead of going to church, why don't you pay me or some other therapist to, you know, do some psychological work with you and get you over this hang-up? And then Karl Marx, another modernist, had argued that religion is the opiate of the masses, that it's a drug fed to us by our handlers, that the aristocracy, whether it's the capitalist aristocracy or the the feudal state of medieval Europe, is in collusion with the church to placate us, to tell us pretty stories in our suffering so that we don't launch anything like a political revolution to demand a better way of life. Anyway, these kinds of theories were very much in vogue in the academy in the 40s and 50s. And so when Houston was first teaching world religions, there was a book by a fellow named Noss, N-O-S-S. And basically it was chapter after chapter of judgment and damnation against the religion, claiming that Hinduism and Buddhism were religions of escape, that it's a religion of people who hate life and want to reach moksha, liberation from it. And so when Houston read these books, he felt like these judgments were to a large extent unfair and wanted to at least describe them accurately.
And that's just such a radical position for someone to take at the time. I mean, your biography does a fabulous job of kind of sketching that out. But I mean, you see what a, you know, salmon swimming upstream kind of undertaking he's engaged in.
Yeah. Now, it's funny because he was making no friends in academia at the beginning of it, but the book became so wildly popular And all over the world, you know, when I interviewed Deepak Chopra for the book, he said he remembered reading it when he was 14, growing up in Delhi, and shared it with his father. And they were both amazed, like, wow, this is the first time we've ever seen a Westerner correctly describe our religion. You know, neither denigrating nor endorsing, simply accurately describing. So that was a huge step.
Let's talk a little bit about that slice of life there when this book explodes and he does become this media celebrity. You have some great black and white photos in the book. One of the ones I really liked is the photo of Houston sitting cross-legged on a desk titled Houston on Television in St. Louis, 1955. Explain that, because I think it really relates to the story in a couple of different ways.
Well, that's why Houston claims the book has always been in print and is still paying his rent at 97 years old, is that the book started as a TV show, not as a book. And he had a young director named Mayo Simons. And every week, Mayo would say, okay, Houston, what have you got for me? Houston would describe what the content of the program was going to be. And Mayo would say, doesn't sound too red hot to me, Houston. And then Houston would go back and jazz it up a little bit and cut to the chase and do something that's hard for academics, cut to the chase. So the program became very, very popular on educational TV, and it got picked up all over the country. And then they said, wow, let's make a book out of this. And so, yeah, that's how the whole thing happened. You know, the part of the story, Alex, is, and it relates to why when Houston acquiesced and said, yes, Dana, I would love to have you write my biography, he said, I want the same treatment you gave Aldous Huxley, who was a great hero and friend of Houston's. And what they shared in common was the perennial philosophy, Huxley's view of the perennial philosophy. And that's a big piece of the Houston Smith success story.
Share with folks the perennial philosophy. Briefly.
Well, you know, in a nutshell, it boils down to what Aldous called the minimum working hypothesis. And the minimum working hypothesis, first of all, it's a hypothesis, and I love that
right,
about
right.
it. Saying, here is a theory that we need to explore.
Yeah.
It's not a dogma to, you know, take with some Kool-Aid. And so the first premise is that there is not only the immanent world of things and objects and people, but there is a transcendent aspect to reality. So there's the world of time and space, but there's an aspect of reality that transcends time and space. That's premise one. Premise two is that transcendent aspect has no firewall between it and the world of time and space. In fact, the world of time and space in this theory is reality is a oneness. So the world of time and space is almost like the outer skin or the manifestation of the transcendent aspect of life. And so reality is immanent. Is transcendent to the world of time and space and immanent as the world of time and space. Then the third premise is that we are capable of experiencing that transcendent aspect of reality. And then the fourth of these premises is that that's what we're here to do. So if we look at the mystical literature of the religions of the world, and mystical literature outside of the religions of the world, then we tend to find these same four points being made over and over and over. And because they do arise perennially, Aldous Huxley called that the perennial philosophy. And Houston embraced the perennial philosophy. And that adds a very interesting aspect to his importance because And if you don't mind me going on for just a minute, I think I can make a really important point about his career.
Sure.
In the world of academia, you had modernists arguing that all religion, you know, is to be thrown away and discarded as old news. In the world of religion, there tended then and there tend to be now two basic camps. One is what I would call inclusivists, and the other is what we can call exclusivists. So exclusivists are saying, my religion is the correct one, and everybody else's religion is stupidity and ignorance. And so they should convert to my religion, whatever that religion might be, whether it's, you know, some very dogmatic form of Christianity or Islam or Judaism or whatever, Hinduism. And then inclusivists are people who tend to say, and I got to tell you, my students are often guilty of this, that all the religions are really just saying the same thing. And what Houston felt very uncomfortable with the first choice, exclusivists, only one religion is right. He also felt uncomfortable with inclusivism because he felt like, well, Buddhism says there is no creator God. In fact, there is no ultimate God at all. How can that be the same thing as, you know, a Jew or a Christian premise, you know, a creator God? So he didn't feel comfortable with either of those camps. And what the perennial philosophy did was create an opportunity to say, maybe there's a transcendent unity of religion. Maybe on a mystical level, what Houston called the esoteric level of religion, we find mystics in the various traditions breaking through to the same kind of insight that is summarized in those minimum working hypothesis I laid out. And that yet again, though, there is this exoteric level of religion, which is what we deal with when we deal with ritual and what we, you know, when we deal with what most people think of as religious behavior on a daily basis, religious architecture, sacred space, morality. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and this is, maybe you want to expound on this a little bit more, but this is where Houston really, you know, I don't want to say is at odds with Huxley, because they seem to have this wonderful mutual respect for each other, but that he is taking things in a different direction. And this exoteric, as you call it, view of religion is really something that is kind of trying to weave through these different camps in a way that no one has really done before. Even religious folks haven't done it. You know, he's very, very progressive. I mean, the extreme progressive Christians, I think, have gotten there now. McLaren, I know, you know, have said, hey, we have to accept all religions equally and fully embrace them if we are to understand our tradition at all. So I see that thread emerging, you know, just recently, but at the time, I think it was really quite a radical shift, and he's kind of out alone on this branch, isn't he?
Well, Houston was, but, you know, it's funny. You know, Huxley was an anti-religion kind of guy. He felt like people that were involved with exoteric religion, like church hierarchies and priests and swamis, that too often, you know, the old saying that power attracts the worst of us and corrupts the best, that people get attracted to church hierarchies and so they can very often actually do more to prevent this mystical insight that, you know, from Huxley's viewpoint, the mystics broke through into cosmic consciousness or enlightenment or whatever you want, Bodhi, Jivan Mukta, in spite of exoteric religion, not because of exoteric religion. That exoteric religion tended to throw up roadblocks. But Houston said, no, we don't. The traditional religions are the tried and true pathways up the mountain of spiritual growth. No need to go bushwhacking up the mountain. So Houston was much more embracive of the traditional perspectives. And you know, one thing that's happened over time is that more and more you see books coming out where people are embracing Houston's viewpoint and saying, you know what, inside of my tradition, XYZ, we do have this perennial philosophy element. We have this mystical, you know, whether we're talking about Kabbalah and Judaism or Cynthia Burgo's book, The Wisdom Jesus, Increasingly, we're seeing an embrace of this mystical side of, you know, religion and spirituality. I mean, my students, they describe themselves as spiritual, not religious. And when you dig down into what they mean, it has this experiential element for them. They don't want to be told what to think in a dogmatic way. They want it to be experiential self-discovery.
Well, and I think we're also seeing an embrace of some of the practical aspects of religion that got thrown away in the baby bathwater kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And that, do we need community? Well, I don't know how and why, but we do kind of have a sense for a need for community. Do we need ritual? Do we need elders who have, and a variety of elders who have walked the path maybe and gone different ways, but they're there as a resource? Do we need a record of the wisdom tradition and writings and stuff like that? So, you know, speak to maybe the deeper insight that Houston Smith, I think, saw ahead of his time again of what was really being dispelled that is useful and is necessary, as problematic as it is.
Well, that's a great question, Alex, or a great prompt. That from Houston's perspective, religion does more than, you know, this esoteric aspect is what he was very, very interested in. But over and over again, for instance, in his book, Why Religion Matters, he argues about how important religion is for finding identity. That, you know, a lot of people today might think I'm going to find my identity in spite of my religion or community, instead of through my religion and community. And Houston, you know, he felt more like if we look at the payoff of religion traditionally all over the planet, when people were born into a community, they were born into a wisdom group that already had answers to life's questions. You know, the French philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty once said, because we're present to a world, we're condemned to meaning. And what he meant by that was, once I realize I'm in relationship to others, and others including other species, other genders, other people, you know, other planets, then what is my relationship to those others? And I start to wonder, what are my responsibilities to the planet? Do I have any? So as life poses these questions, these wisdom groups give you answers, and those answers give you identity, and being part of the wisdom group gives you community. You know, when I interviewed Phil Cousineau, who was one of Joe Campbell's biographers, we were sitting in some cafe near City Lights, I remember, in San Francisco, and he was talking about how important community was and how well Houston understood that, because they're also friends. And I said, what do you mean? You know, can you put that in a nutshell for me? And he said, well, he said, I remember hearing an interview with Janis Joplin, and Janis Joplin said, I'm so sad. Every night I make love to 2,000 people, and then I have to go home alone. And, you know, Phil was pointing out maybe somebody like Aldous Huxley with an IQ somewhere north of 200 and a lot of maturity could function without a community. But most of us like a shoulder to cry on, or like to be a shoulder to cry on. And community is very important. And maybe Janice would have lived longer if she had had the right community.
You know, when we talk about this life, Houston Smith, it's easy to make it sound like a charmed life. You know, and in some ways, I guess it was. I mean, he lives a wonderful life and is living a wonderful life. He is still alive. But it isn't exactly a charmed life. I mean, maybe speak a little bit to his very early childhood, which is quite unusual and is not, I guess, the breeding ground one would expect for what he does. And also the second point I hope you could maybe highlight is how poor he was. I don't think people nowadays can relate to, you know, we think of the starving student today, but I mean, this is at a whole different level.
It was in a lot of ways. And You know, he was born in China, raised in China as the son of Christian missionaries, Methodists. And, you know, the vow of chastity, there is no monastic branch of Methodism, and they don't need one because parsimony was part of the religion. And so I think he really grew up being proud of how humbly his family lived in China. His mother was born and raised in China and spoke fluent Mandarin. And so at a very early age, she impressed on Houston and his two brothers that they would never look down on the Chinese, that they had a rich and beautiful culture, and they weren't there to judge. They were there to help. I mean, his father built a hospital and a school before he ever built the church that he preached in. So it was Christian charity was the religion that Houston grew up in. So at 17, you know, when he came to the United States to start college, he was shocked by, you know, young Christians who felt like all that had come across to them was judgment or hellfire, fire, and damnation. To Houston, Christian charity and the love of Christ is, that was the message that he had absorbed. So he felt no reason to rebel against that at all. And because his mother's arms opened so wide to embrace other cultures, Houston was very willing to do that.
And speak a little bit to this, what I was talking about, him being poor. I mean, I just think it just struck me that, you know, here he is, he's a professor, then he's yep. he's actually on a tenure track, and he can't even buy a used car, and he's hitchhiking around the country, and it's I just think people can't really relate to how poor people were, especially academics.
Well, you know, part of it is choice because, you know, I have a picture of Houston from about 40, 45 years ago when he was teaching at Syracuse. He taught at MIT for 15 years, and then he joined the faculty at Syracuse University and eventually ended up at Berkeley. But he wore the same winter coat that whole time. Like, I saw him a picture from about 3 or 4 years ago, and he still had on that same winter coat. So, you know, he's got a lot of his attention is on wealth defined in a very different way than material objects. So there's one thing. But exactly as you say, Alex, when he and his wife Kendra first started a family, they were living in a trailer in Denver, Colorado. He was teaching at the University of Colorado. And he wanted to meet Aldous Huxley and a fellow named Gerald Hurd. And the only way he had to go visit them, he couldn't even afford a bus ticket, was to, in 1947, hitchhike to California from Colorado. I mean, pretty amazing.
One other thing that I just kind of scribbled down here that I thought you might want to speak to is states versus traits.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good topic to talk about relative to Houston. A good place to begin with that, you know, in some ways, Houston discovered the Dalai Lama. In 1964, Houston was in Dalhousie, India, studying Tibetan Buddhism. And they said, well, you should meet, you know, the Dalai Lama. Houston thought that was a good idea. So he put in a request to meet him. Dalai Lama was in his 20s at the time. And one of the things that Houston was impressed with by the Dalai Lama was that the Dalai Lama would always say, as he still does, my religion is compassion. And so what really had been impressed on Houston from his father's Christian charity that came through in the Dalai Lama's Buddhism was that religion and spirituality, even, you know, some profound experience of oneness with all reality, non-dual consciousness, has no real value unless it stands up on legs and moves around in the world and makes real change. That to have a religious experience that doesn't result in some kind of activism, environmental, social, is just a groovy experience. And Houston had that impressed on him in the 60s while at MIT because he was part of the Harvard Psychedelic Project. And Timothy Leary, who was a close friend of his at that time, when he turned a corner and said, okay, turn on, tune in, drop out. Houston felt that was very, very irresponsible, that he might be pulling the youth of America in deep water.
But let's be clear, Houston was right there with him and Ram Dass, and they had these minor differences about where to take this stuff, and it eventually goes in different ways. But, I mean, Houston seems to have been very much in favor of the basic idea and the basic research behind, you know, is this really getting people to this transcendent state kind of thing? I found that very interesting, right? I mean, because we can't just go by what the way it plays out at the end. At the beginning, they're all thinking that this has great promise for being part of this transformation on a mass scale.
Absolutely. Houston, you know, always points out that when he was involved in the Harvard Psychedelic Project, none of the psychedelics they were working with, primarily psilocybin and LSD, were illegal. He always points that out. He can be very conservative in certain kinds of ways, though philosophically way outside the box. But Houston never reneged on that viewpoint, quite frankly. In 2000, he published a collection of essays that he had written about the spiritual value of psychedelic experience. So he never went back on that. In fact, his article, paraphrasing, but does psychedelic experience have religious import, was published in the Journal of Philosophy. And to this day, it's the most reprinted article in the history of the Journal of Philosophy. And so Houston never let go of that. But what he kept coming back to over and over and over again with every audience he spoke with was traits matter more than states, that yes, these substances might give genuine mystical experience, a higher state of consciousness, but then they must result in improved traits of behavior. And so if they don't change our traits of behavior in a positive direction that those around us can recognize, then the jury has to stay out on their ultimate significance. That's, you know, kind of his final assessment.
I have a quote from the book that I thought reinforces that in a different way. On the paranormal, he says, "No interest in telepathy, astral travel, precognition, or spirit possession. I couldn't see where they had any real value or offered any real meaning. Human nature being what it is, people would still manage to be unhappy and selfish."
There you go. You know, for Houston, it's all about, well, I asked Houston one time, I said, we've both spent a lot of time in Asia and India. And I said, Houston, while you were there, did you ever at any point see something that you would think of as miraculous? Something that, you know, somebody floating in the air or some absolute miracle? And he thought very pensively for a moment and he said, no, can't say I did. But then he said, wait a minute. And then what he basically said was that in his lifelong friendship with the Dalai Lama, he said, now there was a man who from early childhood was trained to believe that he was an incarnation of a cosmic Buddha. And he doesn't have any trace of ego. I would call that a miracle. So that's the kind of miracle that Houston is interested in. And then the rest, you know, I remember growing up reading Spider-Man comic books. You know, even Spider-Man would get acne and he would get depressed about his love life. And and there's a message in there, and the message is, even if we could perform miraculous deeds like fly and disappear and read minds, until we get strayed on increasing our humility, increasing our compassion, then what does it really matter? I mean, it's just something else for the ego to metastasize to.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, you've kind of thrown a different curveball into that mix that I didn't see before, because when you tell that little anecdote about Houston saying he's never experienced or seen that, Wow, that's kind of interesting too, because I think, you know, some people have the paranormal thrust upon them in ways that they can't get around. And if that's your experience, I wonder if you feel the same way. But I'm going to leave that one as a hanging question because we're moving along here in time.
Okay.
And I do have a couple of Skeptico questions for you as well. And since I sent you some links to the shows,
yeah,
I think you know what I mean when I say that.
Right at me, buddy.
Okay. So let me approach this in a somewhat roundabout way. I was listening to the interview you did with Rick Archer on his excellent show, Buddha at the Gas Pump.
Yep.
And you did a great job in that interview as well. Anyone who is interested in this topic further, please check out Rick's interview with Dana on BatGap. It's really, really good.
Thank you.
And at one point, you're talking about ISIS. And you say, we shouldn't call it an Islamic State. And I think everyone gets where you're coming from. The vast majority of Muslims are not terrorists. But I also got the sense that you might have bought into a very sanitized view of the origins of Muslim terrorism, or whatever we call that thing.
Yep.
And the U.S. government's role in creating, funding, and propagandizing that. And I think it's going to, now that's a roundabout way, but I think we're going to get back to Houston Smith here in a minute.
Okay.
Do you have any awareness? Have you ever looked into the deep, deep state connections between the U.S. government and, for example, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the rest of that Muslim terrorism nonsense?
No, not really. I can't say I have. I mean, I know this.
I mean, WikiLeaks, it's been, yeah, the WikiLeaks stuff is out, even reported in the New York Times back when we did Libya that we had partnered with Al-Qaeda. I mean, I was going to even play for you, but it's a little bit off topic, but it's going to get back to on topic. I almost played for you a clip from a State Department press briefing where this one brave reporter, who of course never makes it into the mainstream media, says, hey, you know, the group you're supporting in Syria, you know, there's a YouTube video of them beheading an 11-year-old Palestinian boy. You know, what does somebody have to do to be not on our side on this? I mean, it's just kind of a real mess. It's a horrible story. And we're right in the middle of it.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, that part, you don't have to be a historian of the Middle East to look at the circumstances. I mean, the destabilization of the Middle East that the Bush administration created has, you know, lit the genie out of the lamp, so to speak, in so many ways. I mean, I think if you look at a history of the conflicts in the Middle East going back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration and all that, what you see is that we're constantly trying to pit forces in the Middle East against each other for various benefits, real or misperceived from our perspective. And, you know, to mix metaphors, some of those pigeons have come home to roost that, you know, we've built up one monster to kill another monster. They both become, you know, iterations of other monsters. I mean, I know I'm being nonspecific because this isn't my area of expertise.
Sure.
But if you go back to, you know, the Shah of Iran and what we did there, I mean, when Americans say, why do they hate us so much, then you just have to do a little bit of reading to find answers to those questions.
And I guess the real point I was making that is going to relate back is that things aren't always what they seem. So we can publicly rail against Islamic terrorists, and at the same time, we're the ones behind the creation and funding of these groups. So we all get that if we have any willingness to look beyond the very superficial level that what we get. So
definitely,
here's where I think it turns back to some of the topics we were talking about as it relates to Houston Smith. You know, on the topic of scientism, materialism, which I'm right there with you. We've explored a lot on this show. Materialism is a pretty dumb idea. I mean, it really is.
Yep.
It's been falsified experimentally over and over and over again for at least the last 80 years. Historically, no culture at any point in history has ever believed that we're all just biological robots in a meaningless universe. no one has ever completely turned their back on metaphysics.
That's right. And it's even bad science. I mean, I was just recently
it reading is bad science.
Bernardo Kastrup's book, Why Materialism is Baloney. You know, here's a scientist arguing against scientism on strong scientific foundations.
Absolutely. But here's the twist, is that I don't know that we ever really turned our back. And I think, again, it's kind of this deep state mixed message thing. And we've explored that a little bit. You know, I interviewed a guy a while back, Joe McConnell, psychic spy number one. He was in military intelligence, was a spy. He's in East Germany. He gets poisoned and dies, has a near-death experience. Years later, he shows up in the Stanford Research Institute lab for their Stargate program, where they're doing this remote viewing and psychic spying on the Russians. And out of his secret, top secret folder that's opened in front of him, pops a book by Raymond Moody. And so this is the theme that we see again and again in parapsychology. You know, we have the whole men who stare at goats thing. You know, I mean, we have been doing this dual thing where academia is directed to go one way while the deep state is really looking into all this stuff and trying to see how can we peer into the future? How can we weaponize it? Does demonology work? There was a CIA program on that. We don't know where all that stuff goes. So it's not to say that academia isn't dominated by people who generally believe this materialistic nonsense. It's just, I wonder if the realness or non-realness of scientific materialism is to a certain degree secondary to something else that might be going on. Long, long way of getting to that point. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, what came to my mind is maybe about 7 years ago, 6 years ago, I was in a week-long think tank event at the Esalen Institute out near you in Big Sur. And Russell Targ was there. Two or three people that had been at Stanford Research Institute studying paranormal abilities. And they had been primarily funded by the U.S. government and the military, exactly as you say. I mean, the military was interested in any weaponization of these abilities that could come along. And after 30 years, they stopped doing it. And I said, well, why did you stop doing it? And they said, well, we had proven that these abilities exist, and there was really, but they had no weapons value that we could find. So the military stopped funding these programs. And Russell gave me a copy of a DVD of a NOVA program that had really basically been a summary of the work they had done at SRI. And NOVA had come out with a thumbs up, like, you know, these abilities are real and, you know, more good work should be done with them. And I said, well, why are you giving me this DVD? You know, why don't I just get it online? And he said, well, it mysteriously has been taken offline and you can't find it anywhere anymore. But I had copies, and, you know, my own conspiracy theorist, inner conspiracy theorist is going, well, why did that program disappear? I can find NOVA programs all over the place. So, you know, who knows if work is not still going on with.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason to believe that it would stop. I mean, they're just, and a lot of insiders in the remote viewing community have said it doesn't stop. And so I just wonder sometimes, you know, what we're really looking at and where the truth lies. And in particular, this has been, I mean, my thing has been just to pound away at materialism and talk to these neuroscientists and say, gee, you're not looking at the data. How can you be such a blockhead? And, you know, we've done a bunch of those. And then at some point you go, hey, wait a minute. Is there something else afoot here in terms of, you know, this is a pretty handy control mechanism as well in terms of maintaining the status quo? You know, it's,
yeah,
like you said about your students, you know, hey, that's it. Well, I'm just a biological robot in a meaningless universe. Buy more stuff and kind of don't think too deeply about things.
Right. Placate yourself with material objects. And, you know, maybe you can literally go to the mall and buy your way into happiness, which nobody's ever done. But as the tabloids prove to us every day in the supermarket, there is something to that. You know, the part that I feel is sad is the missed opportunity part. And what I mean by that is if we take these abilities and we look at them soberly and we say, these things are impossibilities inside of the framework of a Newtonian universe. And we say, okay, instead of saying, therefore, they must not be true, so discard them and don't study and analyze them, why don't we say, well, what kind of a physical universe could we describe that would allow us, these abilities wouldn't be contradictions of a new model, if you see what I'm saying. Why demand a science that these things won't fit with when certainly there are models of the universe out there? And there are lots of quantum physicists who are, Nick Herbert comes to mind, who are describing models of the universe that could accommodate these abilities. And if we've, you know, got clinical evidence that they do truly exist, then the burden is on us to create that description, I would think.
I would agree. Or, you know, going back to Huxley, how about using those four premises as a starting point? You know, so even why do we have to start with the physical universe to begin with? And that's just an arbitrary starting point as well. Maybe we are, you know, somehow embedded in the transcendent in a way that we don't understand. That does seem to be where the data points.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it makes better sense of life, because if you say,
right,
well, ontologically, we can't prove, quantify the existence of this transcendent, because if it's beyond time and space, it has no quantity. But if we say, if we move from ontology to epistemology, and we say, okay, let's deal with this mysterious aspect of life from the epistemological world, all of a sudden, this would be a topic for another time, but you can get traction on philosophical questions, for instance, related to qualia. Science, you know, it does really well at quantifying things, but it sucks at qualia questions like, how many paintings are in this room? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's good at that. So there are 20 paintings in the room. Which one is the best one? Okay, science gets no traction on those kinds of questions. You know, what are the correct values for me to have? No traction. And so when we look at religion and spirituality, we find a much more all-inclusive description of reality as human beings explain it.
You know, where I wanted to go as we wrap this thing up is return to the topic of religion. And we talked about the exoteric versus esoteric, and I really, really appreciate where Houston Smith, and to a certain extent, you are coming from on that. And I think it's beautiful and important. And at the same time, I'm challenged by the things aren't always what they seem meme as well. And, you know, how does Houston navigate the Catholic Church's complicity in the rape of little children? I mean, how do you deal with that? How do you talk? And then similarly, how do you talk about cults? You know, David Koresh, I found this tidbit. You know, he was like extraordinarily good at quoting the Bible, could do it from memory, could quote it backwards and forwards. You know, and that was part of his appeal, or Jim Jones. We have this vulnerability to cults. We have this tendency to create evil, even in the most good things. How do we keep that out of this exoteric thing that is religion?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, Houston would always point out that when he was teaching religion, he was teaching the ideals of the various religions and not necessarily the realities, because you know, yes, there's the love of Christ, but then there's also the Crusades. And what he pointed out, and the reason that he felt comfortable just teaching ideals, is he said, well, you know, a music professor doesn't have to teach all the bad music, too. He just teaches the good music. And there's something to that. I mean, I think that's fair. You know, if you're doing a history of the world, then the mistakes that religions make do come up. You know, Houston used to quote Ramakrishna, who once said that religion is like a cow. It kicks, but it does give milk. And Houston wouldn't want to go to the place of denying that there have been reprehensible characters who've been in control of religions over the years. I think that, well, you know, what you're touching on is really why Huxley was anti-religion, right? I mean, from Huxley's perspective, the greatest invention of the scientific revolution wasn't, you know, I don't know, the steam engine or optics or something like that, but the concept of a working hypothesis that whenever something becomes entrenched dogma, that is dangerous for humanity. That, well, you know, people would challenge Houston and they challenge me and they say religion is a problem in the world. And look at, you know, ISIS and look at evangelical Christianity and, you know, whatever they want to pick on, Zionism. And then what I always come back to is something that I learned from Houston, which is that if you look at the most dangerous ideologies of the 20th century, they would be Mao's communism, they would be Hitler's Nazism, they would be Stalin's communism. Well, all three of those ideologies are secularist ideologies. So the problem isn't religion per se, it's fanatical ideology. That's the problem.
But how do we navigate? I mean, what is Houston giving us as tools and ideas to navigate that course? Because that's the part that always seems lacking in that, hey, Mao was just a horrible, horrible figure, no doubt about it. But what do we do?
Well, you know, I think Meister Eckhart once said, what's taken in contemplation must be given out in love. And so, you know, where's the love? Where is the right compassion? That, you know, when we look at the behavior of people in a religion, then we should see that they're trying to build bridges of love, understanding, compassion between people. And if they're not, whatever they're doing shouldn't be claimed as the work of God. You know, that's the way that I would see it. I mean, I think this is why people are in wonder and awe about Pope Francis right now. And I think the reason that they are is because you can see so much love coming out of this person. They're trying to be more embracive. They're trying to be more open-minded. And that is the direction of God. So, you know, broadly defined. I mean, I guess I'm saying there's no easy answer. You know, there's an old Sufi story about God and Satan walking down the road and God picks something out of the ditch and Satan says, "What was that?" And God says, "That was the truth." And Satan says, "Okay, give it to me. I'll organize it for you." That when human beings organize their truths into a dogma, then that creates structure, and structure creates opportunities for power to be, you know, collected. I mean, I think that what we're seeing with the religions today, and maybe this is the answer on some level, is if you think about religion in the United States and Europe today, there is a premium put on the democratization process, that people want more say in the direction of their community. They want to be led less, and they want it to be a sitting in a circle rather than the sage on a stage. And then I think another corrective might be the premium that we put on the sovereignty of personal choice, that if you want to you know, if you want to participate willingly in this community, that's fine, but there's not going to be community coercion to demand your participation. I think those create a more postmodern leveling structure for religion.
Awesome. How do we balance that with the shedding away of some of the things that we talked about, the shedding away of the traditions, the rituals, even some of the holy books, even some of the elders? How do we navigate that balancing act? Do you or Houston have any advice?
Very difficult. I mean, first of all, you know, there's something wonderful about ritual. Families around holidays, even deep secularists, tend to have family rituals, things that they do when they celebrate a birthday. Humans like those markers of the passing of the days of our lives. So I don't know if we want to get rid of ritual. I think that when we confuse, you know, Houston always talks about religion as a means to a goal. And the goal is that the individuals become everything that they can be so that they can feed those gifts into a community so that the community can be everything that it can be. As the individual trees get greener, the forest gets greener, that kind of an idea. And so what structures do we create that create the liberation and the self-actualization of the individual? There's the real, you know, there's the real goal.
Awesome. Well, Dana, it's a terrific book. Again, the book we've been talking about is Houston Smith, Wisdom Keeper, Living the World's Religions, the authorized biography of a 21st century spiritual giant. Our guest has been Dr. Dana Sawyer. Dana, before we let you go, tell people other stuff that you're working on maybe, or how they can learn more about your other work. We mentioned that you did an excellent biography of Aldous Huxley as well. How can they find out more about you?
I have a website, dana.sawyer.com. They'll see me on YouTube and Wikipedia and places like that. The books are for sale on Amazon. I'm pretty easy to find.
Right, right. You are, and they should definitely find you and check you out. It's been awesome having you on the show, and I, again, thank you so much for this wonderful book. I've been a fan of Houston Smith for a long, long time and had the wonderful opportunity to actually see him speak before I even knew I was a spiritual seeker, which is always kind of an interesting twist on things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been great talking with you, Alex. I really appreciate the invitation.
Thanks again to Dana for joining me today on Skeptico. One question to tee up from this interview. We've hit it many times in this show in the past, but since Dana and Houston bring a new perspective on it, do, as Houston calls it, the exoteric aspects of religion make our world religion something worth preserving, cherishing, protecting? Or is the baggage they bring, which we've talked about, enough to send us looking for a new way to access the esoteric, the mystic, the transcendent? Let me know your thoughts on that. Of course, a place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com, where you can leave a comment, jump over to the forum. I've had some good discussions over in the forum. I get so much out of it. I do appreciate people who join, and there's a lot of new people who have joined. And if you're inclined, do it. Come on over there. I'll see your post. We can start a dialogue. If you want to do that, please do it. Or you can reach me on Facebook. I've been less active on Facebook, but maybe I'll get more into that. If you want to reach me, like I say, you can. Please feel free to connect with me. I love connecting with you, and I love what so many of you bring to the show every week. Well, I have a couple of interesting shows coming up. I don't need to say much in advance other than I do hope you'll stick around for all of that. But until next time, take care and bye for now.